The US Department of Justice labels the Big Apple an anarchist jurisdiction. Helsinki airport unleashes coronavirus-detecting canines. And a London mayoral candidate floats a plan to rename the city's tube stations after corporate sponsors. Monocle's editors tackle those topics today on the Late Edition here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Late Edition. My name's Tom Edwards. I'm joined round the table here in London by Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak.
Hello, Tom.
And by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Arimella.
Always a pleasure to sit in front of you.
She lies convincingly. How are we all this fine Wednesday, Chris, in fine fettle? You're a news hound. We've got some canines coming up, but have you been sniffing out any good leads this week?
Oh, my God. Well, always trying to, especially to perhaps that's a segue to say that for those keen listeners, my title has changed to news editor from affairs editor. So I'd just point that out because our affairs section editor, Megan Gibson, is back from maternity leave. And so my position is changing slightly. And so, yes, I will be a news hound from now on radio, on the Monocle Minute and in print.
I was going to say, safe to say, we will quite literally be hearing more from you.
Absolutely, you will hear more from me. I hope our listeners don't mind.
What about cultural sustenance this week, Chiara? Anything electric happening? I don't know.
Well, I've been doing a lot of speaking to journalists in the US because the November issue will include a feature on how much media still has the power to sway voters. And it's a really interesting question. And many people have very varying answers as to how much this can still happen from the pages of a newspaper. Chris here has been helping me contact some of his fellow American citizens, we'll have responses for our readers very soon.
Let's start this program in the United States. Earlier this week, the US Departments of Justice branded New York, Portland, and Seattle anarchist jurisdictions that have, and I quote, permitted violence and the destruction of property to persist. The designation comes in response to recent protests and a memo that President Trump issued earlier this month, asking the Department of Justice to identify any jurisdictions it feels haven't been properly enforcing the rule of law. Jeffrey Howard's a US politics expert and M24 regular. He joined The Globalist earlier today to explain what being branded in this way might mean for the future of those cities.
Grants from the federal government in Washington account for a significant proportion of a lot of American cities' budgets. In New York, this was more than $7 billion in revenue slated to happen in 2021, roughly 7.5% of the city's projected total revenue. So that's not couch change. That's a lot of money that's hanging in the balance here. And if the Trump administration is able to successfully refuse to grant this money to these cities that in many cases has been appropriated by Congress, that's going to be a huge blow to those cities' budgets. So I think there was astonishment and hilarity, but also a sense of real trepidation about whether they'll actually follow through on this. And I think they certainly intend to.
Jeffrey Howard talking to us earlier. Chris Chermak, what exactly is Trump? I mean, it's almost an impossible question, potentially. What was he hoping to achieve here? Is he likely to be successful?
Well, there's two things that he wants, in short. He wants states to do his bidding, particularly Democratic states, and he wants to, more importantly, appear strong on law and order ahead of the U.S. elections that are only a bit more of a month than a month away at this point. I did want to back up a little bit for context, because I think it's interesting that using this whole debate, using federal funds to kind of get what you want, it's not something new, so I think that is important to say. You know, even under Barack Obama, this was actually something that was done quite often. There were a couple of examples that are interesting was one, his education policy, which he called Race to the Top. It was like a $4 billion program of education grants that he only gave to states that would follow certain federal guidelines in terms of what he wanted for education policy. Similarly, on climate change, where he was often frustrated by Congress, he sort of used, federal legislation. He used sort of the EPA, which is the environmental agency, to kind of enforce laws on power stations and things like that within states. So it's often quite common that presidents will try and get states to do their bidding by working with federal funds to do that.
But maybe not labeling them anarchists, though.
That brings us to this. And as with everything, I think for me, Trump is taking a sledgehammer where others have maybe done something a little more specific. You know, he's threatened to block all federal funding to these states. He's taken a very aggressive approach, as you say, calling them anarchist states, saying that they're not violating certain laws, but they're essentially incapable of governing themselves, right? So that's a very, very strong way to talk about it. And that's what, for me, obviously suggests this is so much more about politics. You know, if he did want to get states to actually do what he wanted, he could use incentives. He could, I don't know, you know, offer federal funding for police departments to enact certain reforms, or, you know, things along those lines that would be more specific. He's gone for this very, very wide step. And one other thing that's important to note is, you know, who he's targeted. He's targeted Democratic states. Also, interestingly, though, he has not included Wisconsin and Minnesota, two states that were at the center, really, of the Black Lives Matter movement, of the protests as a result of police brutality and, you know, what happened back in June and earlier this year. They're not included in this list. Why? Well, someone suggests they're swing states, so those are states that he doesn't really want to alienate voters by withholding a bunch of funding. New York, you know, it's a reliable Democratic state. If they get angry with him at this point and they therefore vote for Joe Biden, it doesn't particularly matter. They were going to anyway.
Why choose between stick and carrot if you have a flamethrower option?
Exactly.
It's maybe one way to characterize it. Kiara, look, you know, Chris is right. We're used to seeing these, their political differences, state versus federal. We see, actually, wherever in the world we look, that there are challenges for different levels of government, regional, central. It's hard to make a rule, isn't it, about how well these different levels need to get along to govern effectively. There is no one system that works, right?
Yes, although, and I would bring this back to the context of the pandemic, because I think it gives us a very poignant example of particularly this tension being at play in states, in nations that have very strong regional governments, and where particularly health funding and health administration is devolved to regions. I'm referring specifically to Spain, because I've been reading up, analysis to understand why the situation has gotten quite so bad in Spain in recent weeks and months, I guess, by now. And some of the analysis centers on this idea that there has been a real disjunction in between the actions of national government and regional government. And, you know, I was reading up on the fact that right now national government is, you know, putting pressure on Madrid to take tougher action. But despite getting actively involved, where perhaps before it wasn't, it still wants to avoid confrontation. I think back to my own home country of Italy, where the fact that health authorities are based kind of around regional borders has meant that the approach to the pandemic has been very different from region to region. And in certain cases, this has helped. But it's also created very, very sharp, you know, confrontation. And that does have political consequences. And we see that because only this week we've had results in regional elections in Italy. And I think they paint an interesting picture in that people like Luca Zaia, the governor of Veneto in the north, that has been very, very strict when it came to, coronavirus management, but also very keen to, you know, keep the economy of Veneto, which is one of the productive areas of Italy, going, has garnered incredible support. So 76% of the local electorate voted for him. And then you see these regional figures suddenly rising to the top onto national politics as well. And I think it's interesting to think about the routes that politicians are taking nowadays to get onto national, you know, the national level of politics. We're used to seeing mayors becoming, you know, potentially MPs or PMs, you know, later on. And those mayors often come from, you know, metropolitan areas that tend to be more liberal. At least this is the case often in Italy, whilst regional, you know, governors aren't necessarily always associated with liberal politics. It depends very much on the region, but they're a different crop of politician, right? Mm. And right now we're seeing this different crop of politician, which used to be much more in the background, emerge to the surface. And I think it is reshaping the way that politics on a national level will also be moving forward.
Chris, just briefly, if we take back to the US, do you think that there's an opportunity potentially here for Joe Biden to, you know, talk and be more demonstrative about the fact that he's a unity candidate and that, you know, he can also deliver solutions, political answers to some of these questions that have traditionally involved, you know, state and federal strife. It's another marker of differentiation for him against Trump?
I think so. I mean, I think that's been the line that he's been using throughout this campaign, that he is that united figure. And so, yes, this fight between states and the federal government is just one more way for him to make that point, arguably. I think that's true. It is interesting, I would say, just to jump off of that, that normally what I found interesting about this as well is that it's normally Republicans that, of course, are more focused on states' rights and protecting the right of states to govern themselves. And so that's also something that Donald Trump has reversed, arguably, by taking such an aggressive stance on telling states, you know, in this case, Democratic states, what to do. It would be interesting if that's something that Joe Biden might use to drive a little bit of a wedge, even with conservative voters, to say, hey, if this is what Donald Trump is doing, just wait until he comes after your state.
Let me lead you in a slightly different direction, if you'll forgive the pun. Let's pause for a moment. Helsinki's airport is deploying coronavirus-sniffing canines. Do you see what I was doing there? Following a study that said dogs can identify people infected with the virus in a mere matter of seconds and with pinpoint accuracy. While it's an interesting concept that's caught the eye of international airports across the globe, it does also raise plenty of questions regarding the lack, still, of widespread testing currently available in airports. Monocle's transport correspondent Gabriel Lee appeared on The Globalist earlier to discuss the state of air travel and why some coordination from governments might give people the confidence to take to the skies once again. Here's Gabriel.
I think that there hasn't been nearly enough movement towards standardizing, towards ramping up, towards using some of these latest, you know, rapid results tests in a coordinated way so that governments can feel much safer about allowing people to travel, so that we can take down some of these quarantine requirements and border restrictions that are, my sense is that there's quite a bit of desire to travel at this point, that people are sort of ready to get back to business, to moving around. But because of all these restrictions and because they're changing all the time, it's just so difficult to make any plans, so they opt not to. And I think a good testing program, Lufthansa certainly thinks this, I tend to agree that it could really change things if you had buy-in from governments.
Chiara, you've taken to the skies this summer, I think once or twice. What's your experience been, and has it sort of reflected the disjointed policy approach? Were there any COVID sniffing dogs anywhere en route?
Sadly, no dogs. And I've got to say, also, sadly, no rapid tests, which I think is disappointing. Though, obviously, whenever I have travelled within travel corridors, and therefore it wouldn't have been necessarily mandatory to take tests upon arrival, obviously. I think I can definitely say that there has been, even just in my personal experience, some degree of disjointed approach. I think back even to March, when I last travelled before the pandemic, when the Italian government was already taking temperature at the airport, whilst in the UK that was absolutely not the case. And then later on in the pandemic, flying and having to fill in a certain amount of forms, for example, contact tracing forms. And there were certain situations in which, you know, the filling of said form was strictly enforced and monitored. So, for example, going into Sardinia, it was absolutely mandatory that you fill in the contact form. Otherwise, they would not have let you onto the plane. And there were a couple of people who anecdotally, you know, missed their flight because of this, because they hadn't filled in the very lengthy form in advance. Whilst on the other hand, and this is again anecdotal, I've always filled in a contact tracing form coming into the UK. And when you land, there are plenty of signs around the airport, you know, threatening people who haven't filled in the form with potential very hefty fines. And, you know, there's the messaging around it was definitely very threatening in terms of, you know, there will be consequences if you don't do this. And to my experience, I have not seen it really enforced in the same way coming into the UK. And I think, you know, again, that's just something that is quite obvious and stark in terms of just even the point of departure and the point of arrival, right? Where something is enforced much more strictly when you depart, and then suddenly when you arrive, that's not even the same standard in the length of just the one flight.
Chris, look, huge complexity involved in tackling something like the pandemic, and it's perhaps fanciful to expect quick coordination between governments. But having said that, exactly as Gabriel said, you know, people are trying to get back to business. You can certainly go to certain markets. If you've been in Switzerland, I was in Germany this week. People are back to business. And I think people have a right, don't they, to expect coordination, at least to a far better level than has thus far been delivered.
You would think so. I think people have a right to expect some form of coordination, particularly cooperation is not always that easy, but at the very least, sort of implementing some of the best practices that you hear from other places, that's the kind of thing that makes some sense to me, because, as you say, I think it's, you know, many people want to get back to traveling where they can, but they want to do so in a safe environment. And for me, it's been a little bit interesting, even, you know, watching airlines, I have to say, for that matter, because I get it. So many are in this tricky position also financially. So they're sort of fighting some of these regulations as well. So I think it's important to say, arguably, it's not just governments. It's about this cooperation between public and private sector, and airlines have an incentive to kind of make flying seem as normal as possible. Also to, of course, profit where they can from it, because they are in such dire financial straits in many cases. And so that's led to a lot of pushback, it seems like, when it comes to regulations. And that, for me at least, I felt sometimes that's something that is, you know, dangerous in a way, or at least, you know, people are only going to start flying when they feel comfortable to fly. And so it's interesting, you know, even there's certain airlines that are leaning into that a little bit more. For example, Southwest Airlines in the US, which very specifically was sort of at the forefront of saying, we're going to keep the middle seat open because that's going to make you more comfortable to fly. And so they've been sort of working with passengers as well in that way. And I think that's an important element. You need to make people comfortable to fly, as well as just, you know, protecting the health risks and everything else.
You have to carry all the stakeholders along with you.
Absolutely.
I believe that's what they say. Let's talk finally on the programme, a story from right here in London. Transport for London recently revealed that its ad revenues have plunged by more than 90% thanks to coronavirus. Conservative mayoral candidate Sean Bailey thinks he has the solution to these budgetary woes, floating a plan to rename the city's tube stations after corporate sponsors. The plan would give companies the chance to bid on renaming stations, and according to Bailey, could raise £500 million for TfL over just 5 years. Monocle 24's Carlotta Ribello, producer of The Urbanist, appeared on The Briefing earlier today to explain more.
It is quite an interesting idea. I mean, personally, I don't think it will ever go ahead. But yes, as you say, it comes from Dubai. Dubai has around £419 million in sponsorship for their entire metro network. The metro in Dubai, just for comparison, is not even the size of the District Line just in London. And it's completely self-funded through that. But the thing here, we're not talking about sponsorship space. It's renaming stations. So, you know, the station closest to us, Baker Street, is one of the stations that is most known across the network. Could be called something else. It could be called, you know, the Nike station, or, you know, Knightsbridge station could be renamed after Harrods because it's nearby. So you are removing a bit of identity here. But I think it opens up this broader question about when is it okay for cities to rely on private sponsorship deals to rescue what is essentially a public service.
Kiara, complicated arguments here. But, you know, if it's a question of ensuring that public transport operates smoothly, safely, is that not more important than station names? I don't know. How do you feel? Nike Station or Oxford Analytica Circus? Is that just the reality of the world we're living in?
I think we are not completely unfamiliar with this, the idea of sponsorship of public spaces. But I think it does make a difference when it's public run, public owned spaces, right? So we are used to venues being called things that we don't necessarily associate them with, or you know, literary prizes being called after products that don't really seem to directly relate to them. I think there is a bit more of a question when it comes to publicly owned infrastructure. And I think, you know, the argument that it's a sellout will happen even in the case of stadiums, right? And when it comes to transportation, that's even starker. In saying that, this is not a practice that's just limited even to Dubai. You know, if I in doing some research before this, and of course this is something that's already happening in the US, that it's happening in other countries in Southeast Asia, for example. So it's not a new practice. And in fairness, you were pointing out just earlier that it wouldn't even be a first for London, because Emirates already sponsors a airline, in fact, across the Thames.
It's the only corporate sponsor that already appears on the famous Harry Beck London Underground map, the Emirates airline. But again, that caused a lot of outrage, and I guess people are upset that they see this as an encroachment into their sort of collective cultural heritage almost, because these stations have been, you know, Baker Street, said on the Metropolitan Line, has been there for 130 odd years. There's a preservation point as well, though, isn't there, about sort of cultural integrity? Or do we just need to look at, look, you could make billions of pounds, so that trumps everything else?
I do feel for TfL because, again, anecdotally, you know, having travelled on the tube in recent months and seeing the ads that are on there that are still, you know, most remarkably, the one that always strikes me getting off the tube is an ad for a production at the West End that's Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. And it says underneath, must end 23rd of April. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, it really did have to end, didn't it? But yes, what I'm trying to say is that there are certain places in which corporate sponsorship takes a bit more naturally. You know, we're quite used to the Emirates Stadium here in the UK. Some places, even in that world, where it still sticks out a little bit, because I don't know how many people are generally enthusiastic about going to Bet365.
Everyone in Stoke can't wait to get there, Kiara, on a Saturday. Well, not at the moment, obviously. Christian, I might just briefly, I'll bring you in here. Monocle Station? That trips off the tongue, doesn't it? That could be Baker Street. It's only around the corner. Or does it leave a bad taste for you?
I was going to say, it would have to be Baker Street, wouldn't it? Because that's, you know, where we're located. So, yeah, but it does take time, I would say. So we need to be around for a while, I would argue. Or we need to get started right now. We need to name it tomorrow. And then 30 years from now, it'll be just entirely common knowledge. I think that's the way that it does work best, perhaps. And you know, I was thinking when we were talking about this of examples from the US where this has been happening for so long, that as Kiara, you mentioned with Emirates Stadium, you know, Wrigley Field in Chicago, many people don't even know about was because of Wrigley Gum, the owner. So there's examples like that. And sometimes I have to say companies might be a little bit clever in how they do this. The other example I thought of from the US was when Capital One took over the park of the Washington Capitals in Washington, D.C. And so that made it a very simple name change where it was like, oh, this is actually quite nice. Before, I think it was Verizon Center, and then it became the Capitals Center. So that was actually perfect. So every now and then, a corporate group will get it right. They just want their name out there. I think that's clear. Is it always a good idea? I do struggle with it as well. I mean, would people really enjoy getting out at Monocle Station? Would that just feel...
Oh, I think they'd enjoy Monocle Station, Chris, for sure. But let's be fair, I'm not sure that Sean Bailey... I don't want to preempt the mayoral race. Sean Bailey may not be putting his ideas into practice, I think it's safe to say. Kiara Rimella, Chris Chermak, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on today's late edition. Thanks to all our editors today and to our studio manager, David Stevens, behind the glass. I'm Tom Edwards here in London. Goodbye, and thanks for being with us.